Population approximately 120,000 in Panama. Population approximately 4.2 million. After millions of deaths of Americans and foreigners and trillions of dollars lost in places like Vietnam, Afghanistan, and the West Asia, is the U.S. any safer and secure because it fought these losing wars in far-off lands? No, of course not. Have the American people benefited from these wars? No. Hundreds of thousands of troops have been killed or wounded, and trillions of dollars have been spent. So if the American people don't benefit from these endless losing wars, why do they keep fighting them? The short answer is that there are powerful forces in America that get rich from endless wars. The military-industrial complex and its political and economic servants and enablers. As Code Pink tweeted recently, President and former General Dwight D. Eisenhower warned in his 1961 farewell address to the nation, "We must never let the weight of this military-industrial complex endanger our liberties or democratic processes. Only an alert and acknowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals," unquote. Drive around the wealthy suburbs around the nation's capital and look at the multi-million dollar Mac mansions owned by corporate executives and lobbies, who are the real beneficiaries of America's forever wars. During the Afghanistan war, the stocks of the five largest defense contractors outperformed the S&P 500 by 58%. Fortunes end up in the pockets of corporate executives. They and their companies spend tens of millions of dollars lobbying Congress and contributing to Republican and Democratic politicians alike to buy their support for forever war and defense budgets totaling 60% of the federal government's discretionary spending. That's why, even as the Afghanistan war is ending, much of the corporate elite and the corporate media is getting up a new Cold War with China to justify continued overspending on the military. The main danger to U.S. security is not a military invasion by a heavily armed superpower enemy. Bigger national security threats today are climate change, cybersecurity, and global pandemics. These will not be addressed by spending more on the traditional military and fighting more losing forever wars. They require popular resistance to the military-industrial complex, the defeat of politicians under payroll, and the transformation of American priorities from preparing for and fighting useless wars to addressing the climate, economic inequality, and equal justice. As Warren Gunnels, staff director of the Senate Budget Committee, put it, "The only thing that we accomplished by going into Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan was to put trillions of dollars into the military-industrial complex and destroy millions of lives, period, full stop. It's time to stop repeating the same mistakes over and over again."
covering Islam.
The story of Tawheed is not limited to the creation of the world or oneness of God. Another important aspect of Tawheed is that we have to worship the one and only God. But why should we worship God? What is the purpose of worship? Why should we worship a God who does not benefit from our worshiping? And why is worshiping anything beside or in association with God the greatest sin according to the Quran? Man is a worshipping being and cannot be free from worship in one form or another. If we do not worship God, we worship other things, even including our ideas, our aspirations, or our desires. The moment we cease to worship, our life is disrupted.
The word in Arabic for worship is Aliha, which is used in the phrase La ilaha illallah. The word Aliha actually means a number of things. It means to worship. It also means to be obsessed with. It also means to rely on someone in time of need. It also means to be in love with someone. It also means, continuing the idea of obsession, to not be able to think of anyone else. To feel or to miss someone intensely when they're not present. And so when we say La ilaha illallah, we are saying there's no one worthy of worship or of love, of obsession, of reliance. No one worthy of me turning to them in time of desperation and need other than Allah.
Tawheed in worship is one of the most important aspects of Tawheed. For it's not a matter of belief anymore, but a matter of action as well. It shows how committed one is in their faith. It is the manifestation of the soul and heart of a believer in their practice.
Worship in action includes that your intention, you have to have ikhlas, which means pure sincerity for the sake of God. Not your ego, not to please others, not to please society, but to please the one that created you.
Worship is to adore, to praise, and to humble oneself towards the object of worship. The Quran states that some people take their fleeting desires as the objects of their worship.
Have you seen the one who takes his own base desire as his Lord? So associating partners to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not only worshipping an idol. The individual might worship his own lower self. When I'm obeying other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that can be my nafs. That itself is a form of shirk. As we know, we have two different types of shirk. The first type is shirk al-khafi. Shirk al-khafi is the hidden shirk. And the second type is shirk al-jali. It is the apparent one. The apparent one is the person in the temple worshipping, if he's truly worshipping the idol. But the khafi one, the hidden one, the minor shirk, is me taking my lower desire, taking the power, taking the position, taking my wealth as my Lord. And both of these types of shirk takes me to destruction, because it's taking me away from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
All human beings are bound to worship something. It is in our nature to worship. The only thing is, are we picking the right authority, or the Quranic word is ilah, or God, to worship? Quran actually details a few false gods. For example, Hawa, the god of desire. So if we were to become like bird or servants of desire, what would happen to us? We would be destroyed. We would have self-destruction. We would not be able to live our lives in the best way possible. So it is indeed our nature to worship something and our best interest to worship Allah.
You have people who are free of the worship of God, who free themselves of the worship of the Creator. However, that's not to say that it's not replaced by the worship of something else. So you see people who don't worship God end up worshiping earthly pleasures, they end up worshiping money or power, they end up having addictions which become like a kind of worship because there is such a strong dependence on them. So man can free himself of worship of God's, man can free himself of God's worship simply because he has the free will to do so. However, that's not to say that it's a choice without consequence.
In our day-to-day experience, we can see how sometimes we are humble to and infatuated by our desires. This is because realizing those desires is very important to man, and thus he is prepared to humble himself before anything that may help him to bring about what he wants and to realize his desires. And this is probably how idol worshiping came about.
Idol worship is an aberration of the heart and mind. Idol worship is essentially the ego, because I think all idol worship stems from self-worship. Because there's going to be an element where you're going to be worshipping your ego, because your ego is that veil that prevents you from seeing the truth.
People used to worship idols because they thought they controlled the sources of what they sought. If they wanted a child or money or victory or good harvest, there was a god for each of them who could fulfill their need. It was sheer material need which made them to turn to God. And since God was so transcendent, they sought more immediate deities to talk to.
Many people find it very difficult to understand a transcendental God, a God that is everywhere, but at the same time so far away from us. A God who is all-powerful, but we're so impotent. A God who is living everywhere, but we will die. A God who is powerful to do anything, yet we can struggle to do anything. When there is that very big gap between where we are and where God is, there feels that there needs to be some sort of intermediary to get there. And that is where this idea of idol worship happens. And the idea that they can worship someone who acts as a mechanism to get to the purest God.
The big question is, why has God placed this sense of worship in man? Why are we instructed to worship him? Is he in need of us worshiping him?
Well, I would never want to worship a God that actually benefits from me. That would mean God is not God anymore. It means he's weak, he's needy. God's name is the free. Al-Ghani, he is free, he is independent, he is self-subsisting. That deserves to be worshipped.
Fundamental to the conception of God in Islam and in the Quran is that he is independent. He is needless. هو الغني. The verse continues, وأنتم الفقراء. You are the needy. You are the dependent. So God does not need our worship whatsoever.
وما خلقت الجن والإنس إلا ليعبدون. How should we interpret this verse in the Quran, which states that God has not created jinn and human being, but to worship him?
Some people misunderstand this ayah and think God just wants us to just be praying to him all the time and do nothing else, just pray, because we have no other purpose in life. Actually, all the other things, like, it's the same God who said, وَجَعَلْنَا لَكُمْ فِيهَا مَعَايِشَ. He put on the earth things for you to live well. He wants you to live well in this world. He wants you to dress well, eat well, sleep well, have a nice family, enjoy yourselves. He wants those things for you. And guess what? When you do them, you are actually fulfilling a command of Allah by utilizing the things he made for you.
People sometimes make objections as to why, if God does exist, he needs to be worshipped. Surely if God exists, he is free of any such need. Why do we have such a needy God who needs to be constantly told that he's right, that needs to be constantly told that he's great? However, really the truth is that, of course, God doesn't need to be worshipped at all. And we don't worship God because it is in any way adding to his being or taking away from it if we are not worshipping him. We worship God because we need to worship God, because we need to have a sense of grounding and a sense of direction. We worship God as a reminder of who put us on this earth, as a reminder of why we are here, and as a reminder of where we will ultimately end up. If we don't remind ourselves of God and of his existence every single day, we would very soon forget. And then where would we be? Where would we be? We would be completely lost.
Thus, the only meaning that we can imagine for this verse is that worship brings us closer to him. And by him, we mean the absolute perfection. If I want to get closer to perfection, or if I want to become perfect myself, I need to take this perfection or these attributes from the source of perfection.
Worshipping God has nothing to do with him requiring it. God is considered to be Ghani. He is needless of any of our worship. But at the same time, it is us who need that worship. We need this opportunity to really excel in this life. Why? Because that will help us in the hereafter. And it will help other people in this world. And that's the core essence of why we are here. We need to have this opportunity to excel.
So what is the purpose in this worship? The purpose in this worship is nothing more than for humankind's benefit, to help humankind move towards those pinnacles of existence and to take on those godlike qualities in their life.
The famous verse which states that God only created man and jinn to worship him clearly states that the aim of the creation is the journey towards God. And let's be reminded that God is the source of all perfection. Hence, the conclusion is, this life is about worshipping him, i.e. is about taking this journey towards perfection.
There remains another essential question here. How should we worship God? Are rituals enough as worship?
Ritual performance is nothing if it isn't a means towards godliness and goodliness. And we see this throughout the Quran. Worship in its truest sense is servitude towards God, to become as God would like one to be. This isn't done through the performance of any ritual. Rituals are purely instrumental.
Worship means obedience. Worship means submission to the will of God. Worship does not mean that you constantly sit in the direction of Mecca and continue to pray and pray and pray. As long as you are living your life according to the will of God and you are not disobeying, every single breath that you're taking is worship.
Too often we talk about worship solely in terms of ritual. We talk about worship solely in terms of doing things. Whereas worship in itself is the remembrance of God as God should be remembered. It is the remembrance of God in a way that reminds us of his greatness. And if what we are doing, whatever ritual we are performing, is not reminding us of the greatness of God, then really it is not an act of worship, it is mere ritual.
In other words, anything we do in this world in remembrance, love, and obedience of God can be regarded as an act of worship.
To summarize it is to love God, to obey him, and to worship him. And that translates in many things. Praying 5 times a day, doing dhikr, which is the remembrance of God, actually being in service to your fellow human beings is also a form of worship if you're doing it for the sake of God. And that's worship in action in a way, when you're doing actions like serving others and giving acts of charity. Because we believe that acts of worship, but the only true worship if you do it for the sake of God.
Worship is an evolving process. And when one worships with an understanding of what God is, one always has to work towards perfection.
So our ritual fasts and prayers are not the only acts of worship. Our love for our family and relatives, any help extended to fellow human beings, to win bread for our dependents, could as well be regarded as acts of worship.
A vicarious remembrance. Look at the signs. Look at what is around you. And you will get the feeling that he is with you even though you don't see him. And the final step, which is excellence, al-ihsan, is to worship him as if you are seeing him. But how? Out of love. In kuntum tuhibbun Allah. Worshipping is to love, is not only to abide by the rules. You abide by the rules because you love, and you show your love because you abide by the rules. So it's a virtuous cycle, and this is the meaning of worshipping.
Apart from the acts we offer as worship, worship has an essence. Its essence is based on placing one's hope and fear in God alone.
Tawheed in worship means that the type of humility, obedience, fear, and hope offered to God should not be offered to anyone and anything else. This is the path to man's perfection, because it emancipates human heart and soul from all other types of worship.
Idol worshipping is considered a great sin, and the reason for this is because the very feeling instilled in man to bring him closer to God is diverted to leave him further away from God.
When you have a relationship with the one who is all perfect, because that's who he is, and he is the most beautiful, and he's the most perfect, and he's the most loving, then you want to emulate those qualities in your life. You want life around you to be more and more beautiful. You want more and more love in your life. You want more and more, you know, better and better things in your life. Because at the end of the day, this quest will come to a conclusion when you finally meet him and you actually get to see perfection itself.
But should we fear God or love him? Are fear and love compatible with each other? The Quran actually advises us that at the same time that we love God, we have to fear him as well. And different experiences of fear are mentioned in the Quran, or different levels of fear. Taqwa, khashya, shafaqa, rahba are but some examples.
The relationship between fear and love is one which is seen as a dynamic in Islam, okay, and often portrayed as such. They can be two sides of the same coin, okay? And fear and love are not wholly incompatible. Absolutely not are they wholly incompatible. Having said that, the predominant ethos of the Quran is one of love, okay, as is encapsulated in that repeated reference to God as being Rahman and being Rahim, the unqualified giver.
Every relationship comes with love and fear. Why is it so hard to understand with God? We have to love him, and we have to be afraid that he might be upset about something. But if your relationship in this world, if your relationship is only love and you're never afraid, like if I think about my wife, yeah, I love her, but I'm never afraid of disappointing her. I'm never worried about saying something that might hurt her feelings. I might think the relationship is perfect, but she might actually think that I don't care about her anymore. If my relationship with her is only about fear, oh my God, she's going to get angry. If I say something, she's going to get so mad, right? Then over time, I will lose all love for her. All that's left is fear.
We have to start with loving him. Once we base our understanding on rationality, then you cannot but love him. Fear, of course, there are consequences to our decisions. These consequences can be consequences between us and God, or things that affect people around us. Punishments is part of the equation, is part of the existence. You take the wrong decision. The Quran states is that not that God has ascribed certain punishments to this wrong decision. Your wrong decision itself, in reality, has these negative consequences.
Taqwa is the beginning of all those different levels of fear. And it is the beginning of worship. It is faith put to application. It is fear of losing God's support and trying to win his favor. But our fear of God is not purely for the consequences. It is sometimes an awesome experience of his greatness.
Khashya is a fear as a result of knowledge and leads to action. It is when you know the greatness and the magnitude of what you fear, and as a result, you have reverence of it. There is another type of fear mentioned in the Quran, which is referred to as rahab. Rahab is the kind of a fear that makes you very alert, very careful, and does not let you relax. It is like the type of fear that the students have during exam time. They're careful, they're restless, and they're concerned about their passing. It is also fear that you're afraid that you will disappoint the one you love. The final type of fear which is mentioned is shafaqa. Shafaqa is the fear that some harm will come to a person you love. It is that type of fear. It is a fear that is mixed with love, such as the love of a mother for her children. She is fearful out of love for them.
If worshipping God is so important for the perfection of man, what happens if it is directed to concepts, objects, or persons other than God?
It's a divergence from the straight path. Does it have consequences? It does. Because we are meant to direct our thoughts and our actions with the unlimited being that is God. Once we attach ourselves to a limited form of existence, i.e. any form of an idol, because he's limited, our journey towards perfection will be very limited and very short, and it will hinder our progress towards perfection. So to free ourselves and to go back on the straight path to that endless journey towards the absolute perfection, we need to be free from idol worshipping and direct this energy and this fellowship to God and God only.
Well, when you worship your own desires, for example, avid materialistic culture, avid individualism, you have social breakdown and decay. If you look at the Children's Society report that was published in 2009, it came to the conclusion that our societies are breaking down because of what? Avid, excessive individualism. What's in it for me? I'm all right, Jack. And that, in a way, is worshipping the ego, is worshipping a false god. So it does have negative consequences in society, definitely.
Associating partners with God is an utter misjudgment. Now, that's because Allah is the reality, and what he invokes besides him is nullity. Chapter 22, verse 62, he is the only source of good, perfection, or existence. This implies those who evoke others besides him are under an illusion.
But fear is only one leg of worship. The other very important component of worship is hope. Hope to go closer to God and to be included in his favor and mercy. Hope to be good enough to be loved by God and to be granted his love in our hearts. It's only through these two components of fear and hope that the true worship is realized. And that is something that should be offered only to God and no one but God.
through worshiping God that we can expand and develop our God-given faculties. Associating partners with God would not only stop that process, but it is showing ingratitude towards our Creator. It is only by acknowledging that all beauty comes from God and all praise is due to Him that man can be accomplished. Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk more about the creation of man. Until then, peace be with you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Thanks to the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, the Palestinian issue was saved from being completely forgotten. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading, Only Islamic Unity Will Salvage Al-Aqsa Sanctity. Here's more on this issue. What makes Palestinian Muslims in Beit al-Muqaddas and the Muslim world being helpless watchers or, at the most, harmlessly angry protesters at the frequent violation of the sanctity of Islam's former Qibla or prayer direction, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, by Zionist marauders supported by Israeli regime occupation forces? the disunity of the Islamic Ummah, of course, in view of the treason of several regimes in power in Muslim lands, not as representatives of the people they rule, but as clients of the US regime. Recently, the Palestinian Islamic Council expressed alarm that the Zionist regime's stepping up of excavations and drilling underneath the sacred precinct of Al-Aqsa is weakening the foundations and may result in the collapse of the whole structure. Its statement indicated disunity at home amongst the Palestinians when it said engagement in real estate deals with Israelis is a great betrayal of religion, the homeland, and morals. Whoever colludes with this crime is a conspirator against the land, the cause, and the people, and has sold himself to the devil. It shows the depth of despair amongst the Muslims 52 years after the arson attack by Australian Zionist terrorist Dennis Michael Rohan on Al-Aqsa on August 21st. That made Muslim countries meet in Morocco to form the Organization of the Islamic Cooperation, OIC, which unfortunately has done nothing concrete for Beit al-Muqaddas. The fire destroyed nearly a third of the mosque, including the 1,000-year-old priceless wood and ivory pulpit, as the Israelis cut off water from the area and prevented fire engines from reaching the site to extinguish the fire. Though the Muslim countries succeeded in pressuring the UN on September 15, 1969, to adopt Resolution 271 to denounce such a violation, no further progress was made to prevent the Zionist regime from its frequent violation of the sanctity of Al-Aqsa and the current intrusion into this sacred Islamic site by gangs of illegal Zionist settlers, despite the fact that entry of non-Muslims or their acts of worship are strictly banned. The reason is obvious. It is the disunity of the Ummah. If Morocco and Jordan, which before the Israeli occupation of Beit al-Muqaddas in 1967 was in charge of governing this Islamic city and its holy sites, were in secret contact with the illegal Zionist entity, the traitor Anwar Sadat of Egypt openly betrayed the Palestinian cause by signing the scandalous Camp David Accord. Thanks to the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, however, the Palestinian issue was saved from being completely forgotten. Historic move by the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, in designating the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan as the World Poets Day, not only mobilized Muslim masses all over the world for renewing allegiance every year to the cherished goal of liberating Al-Aqsa in Palestine, but made Iran the fulcrum of the resistance front for practical efforts to achieve this objective. Today, despite the Israeli regime atrocities, all eyes are glued to the Islamic resistance front, which is becoming stronger day by day, and from Gaza has now penetrated the interior of the usurped land of Palestine for delivering the coup de grace. It means that they will surely dawn on a leaven free of the filth of Israel, no matter if certain Persian Gulf Arab regimes indulge in treason and treachery by dallying publicly with the Zionist entity.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Why did Imam Hussein take his family to Karbala? Imam Hussein was aware of the consequences of his movement. He was an infallible Imam. Infallible Imams' extensive knowledge and insight are beyond our heads. If those great tragedies had not happened to the shrine of the Holy Prophet, to Imam Ali's daughter and to the Holy Prophet's descendants, this event would not have gone down in history. The event that could have prevented that great deviation had to shock people and history as much as the deviation did. This shows Imam Hussein's self-sacrifice. Of course, this is easier said than done. What Imam Hussein did was an extraordinary feat. That is to say, the dimensions of his action are far more than what we estimate. We usually ignore aspects and details. Once I spoke about Imam Hussein's patience. His patience was not limited to enduring thirst or seeing his companions being killed. These things are relatively easy to tolerate.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لاتشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لاتشان
أنا لاتشان
The kind of patience that is difficult to practice is to listen to influential, aware and respectable people who keep creating doubts and telling you that what you are doing is dangerous and wrong. Who did those things? People like Abdullah Ja'far, Abdullah Zubair, and Abdullah Abbas. These prominent figures of that time were constantly telling Imam Hussein not to do what he was doing. If it were somebody else, somebody who did not have that determination and stable character, he would have thought, well, I did my duty. These people are talking like this and the world is acting like that, so I should just say what I'm supposed to say and do nothing else. A person who decides to stand up against such statements, such temptations, such doubts, and such efforts to bend Sharia and is not dissuaded from continuing his path, such a person is the one who can give rise to such a great transformation. In this regard, our magnanimous Imam was similar to the Lord of the Martyrs. I explained this in another meeting, and I do not want to go into the details now. This was how Imam Hussein acted as a guardian. July 4th, 2011.
Thank you.
diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Round the World with Reporters.
The situation in the Afghan capital Kabul is getting worse as a big chaos is ongoing in and around Kabul International Airport. Thousands of Afghans rushed to Kabul International Airport only a day after Taliban took control of the capital Kabul almost a week ago.
Walkan Barahar, this is a tragedy for every single Afghan national. The U.S. claims that it has spent $1 trillion in Afghanistan. No, they were not after making good governance system in our country. They were only after imposing the current situation on our people and Afghanistan.
Chaos in Kabul Airport has so far resulted in the death of at least 20 Afghans, including women and children. The horrifying situation in and around Kabul International Airport has created a big chaos.
People had heard something about the evacuation of Afghan nationals by the U.S. and other foreign troops from Kabul International Airport. So thousands of them gathered around the airport to get into it. But it was just a rumor because even many passport holders couldn't get into the airport.
This comes as the Taliban blamed the U.S. forces for failing to bring the situation under control in the airport, an issue that, according to the Taliban, has led to the loss of civilian lives. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The hasty and chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has rattled the idea that the South Korea-U.S. alliance is as, quote, ironclad, as diplomats say. Analysts suggest that the presence of U.S. forces here in South Korea serves U.S. interests, both in terms of deterring North Korea and for checking the expansion of China's influence. But those U.S. interests didn't prevent former U.S. President Donald Trump from threatening to remove U.S. forces from South Korea to force Seoul to pay more for hosting U.S. troops. South Korea's hosted tens of thousands of U.S. troops on dozens of bases throughout the country since the 1950 to 53 Korean War. As a U.S. ally, Seoul is expected to participate in U.S. missions abroad. Security policy analyst Lee Tae-ho argues South Korea's automatic participation in U.S. conflicts is unjustified.
The National Assembly's approval to dispatching troops to Afghanistan and Iraq indicates that South Korea participates in such a war to support American counterterrorism warfare. And unfortunately, the Korean government does not provide any official evaluation afterwards.
For South Korea, the U.S. failure in Afghanistan provides lessons to the South Korea-U.S. alliance and its strategy of entering and occupying North Korea, if and when Pyongyang is no longer in control.
Even though military forces from all over the world took part, it only showed that taking one country by force is not sustainable. For us, it implies that the current military plan between South Korea and U.S. of invading North Korea when it becomes unstable is in fact unrealistic.
He also suggests the South Korea case is different from Afghanistan, as this country has its own advanced military to deter North Korea, although more emphasis needs to be given to negotiations with Pyongyang. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Pro-Palestine activists in England have caused major disruption once again for Israeli arms manufacturer Elbit Systems in Oldham on Monday, after members of the Palestine Action Group occupied one of Elbit's buildings in an attempt to halt the firm's activities. Press TV arrived on location just hours after the stunt was launched.
This isn't the first time that this particular facility has been targeted by Palestine Action, and the group say that they will continue to target sites like this until there is a significant change for the Palestinian issue. Now, they have claimed that they have a long queue of future potential activists lining up to conduct this type of action. And that's because there are many, many people in the general public that feel as if they want to do more for Palestine, and they seem to have reached the conclusion that they have little alternative but to do radical action like what we see taking place behind me in order to force the issue.
As well as occupying the roof, some activists blocked the main road, while others smashed windows before smearing the building in red paint. The colour symbolises the blood of Palestinians killed in Gaza.
These people are saying, here's pots of red paint, we want to stop arms. At some point in time, the arms trade will be as vilified as the slave trade was a couple of hundred years ago, and that's what we intend to achieve through this. Here behind us, many people don't even know it's Elbit, because it used to be called Ferranti. It doesn't have a big Elbit sign up. It should have a big sign saying, Elbit, killer of Palestinian children. That's the sign it should have outside.
Due to the illegal nature of these protests, the activists will be arrested. Some already carted off as we arrived. The activists also risk fines, lengthy court battles, and possible jail time. Yet, they keep coming back.
No, Elbit is going to close this factory. I give you that as a promise. Elbit's profits are what we want to hit. Elbit as an organisation we want to hit. Elbit will go away because there is enough protest from the communities of this country outside of its factories to say, we do not want your bombs. We want to free Palestine.
Oldham's site is used to manufacture specialist military products, which have been used in successive Israeli attacks on Gaza. So, while Gaza remains besieged, Palestine Action vows to continue, as they put it, occupying the occupiers. Robert Carter, Oldham.
For the third day, Iran's parliament has been reviewing the qualifications of President Raisi's proposed ministers. Iran's struggle to contain the resurging coronavirus pandemic took central stage in parliament, as the president's pick for health minister Bahram Einollahi was up for debate. As is the rule, one supporter and one opponent took the podium to speak for or against the nominee.
The coronavirus is killing at least 500 of our people every day. Not only is it taking people's lives, but it's overshadowing their businesses. The next health minister needs to be a powerful manager to steer our country out of the existing health crisis.
The health minister to be then had 30 minutes to defend his qualifications.
We must impose a serious lockdown in the country. If we shut down our cities for only 2 weeks, it will not help stem the tide of the pandemic. Instead of fining those who breach the lockdown, we must prevent travels and gatherings until the virus is totally gone.
Among the cabinet's hotshots was Hossein Amir Abdollahian as the proposed foreign minister, who, if approved, will lead Iran's team in the Vienna talks, aimed at reviving the ailing nuclear accord signed in 2015 between Tehran and the world powers. The nuclear negotiations faced a hiatus following the end of former President Rouhani's term and the election of Raisi as the new president. Now, as Europe is urging Iran to come back to the negotiating table, Amir Abdollahian apparently does not find talks with the West as the ultimate solution to the country's troubled economy.
Our foreign policy won't be restricted to a specific region. It won't tie foreign policy to the nuclear deal. As we try to remove the sanctions, we also make our best to neutralize the sanctions.
Ebrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to Parliament on August 12th. A week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president, legislators then held 270 private meetings with the 19 proposed ministers to review their credentials. The open floor vote of confidence sessions kicked off on Saturday and are planned to culminate on Tuesday. But some MPs believe the process has been slow and may take longer to conclude.
The results of the vote of confidence process will shape the future of the country in many ways, from Iran's foreign policy and the fate of the nuclear deal to the country's battle against the resurging coronavirus pandemic. That's why lawmakers say they're trying to be meticulous in reviewing the credentials of the nominees. So the process may take longer than planned. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's parliament.
In an interview with the Al Khanadiq website, the head of Yemen's negotiating delegation for peace, Mohammed Abdel Salam, said the UK presence on Yemen's soil is not new, and Yemenis reject any form of foreign presence on their land, and it is the right to fight those who come to invade the country militarily.
Since the beginning of the war, Yemeni people have rejected the foreign presence in any form and cannot accept that. We have made great sacrifices for our freedom and independence and to clean our land from foreign forces. Today, the world is following what is happening in Almara Governorate. People of Yemen cannot accept the Saudi British occupation of Almara, and we have come to the conviction that armed struggle is necessary to expel foreign forces, whether in Almara or elsewhere.
Regarding the developments in Marib, Abdel Salam said the liberated areas from forces backed by the Saudi-led military coalition in the Western Governorate are equal to the size of two Persian Gulf states. The chief negotiator added that battles are still going on in Marib and other fronts. He said the recent initiative offered by Yemen's Ansarullah movement is the key to end the war that the coalition started against Yemen in 2015, but Saudis have no real intentions to move politically. However, he noted that the initiative is still in force.
The other party must accept the initiative presented by Ansarullah because it establishes a comprehensive political solution. The other party will regret it if they didn't respond to this initiative because it aims to stop the war completely and end the suffering of Yemenis. Unfortunately, Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates are the ones who have put the power to decide, and we are ready to talk with the Yemeni parties if they have enough courage to take action by themselves.
Recently, the Saudi-led coalition has intensified its air raids on Marib in what experts describe as a desperate attempt to back the Saudi-backed forces on the ground as the Yemeni army keeps marking new advances toward the city of Marib.
Experts believe that Ansarullah has the upper hand as the Yemeni army keeps advancing toward the city of Marib. They say Ansarullah's initiative is a great opportunity for Riyadh to get rid of the quagmire it's stuck with its war on Yemen. The Abdul Latif Loshari, Sana.
Seoul Metropolitan Government's Yongsan City Memorial Exhibition Hall is holding an exhibit, July 16th Yongsan. It shows footage for the first time in South Korea of the July 16th, 1950 U.S. bombing of Yongsan, Central Seoul's district, which killed hundreds of civilians. U.S. B-29 bombers sent to destroy military targets like Yongsan Station switchyard.